This is Audible.
The House of Night and Chain, written by David Annandale, read by Dougal Bruce Lockhart. Prologue. Then. "It's haunted," Katrin said the first time she saw Malvale. She spoke with the adamantine assurance of an 8-year-old, and Xander, who was 4, began to cry. "It is not," Eliana said. She crouched beside our daughter and gave her a hug, but her face showed alarm at Katrin's blasphemy. "Never say that." I lifted Xander in my arms. He rested his face against my shoulder, wetting my uniform with his tears. He did not turn his eyes from the house, though. He stared at it, terrified. His sister's statement confirmation of what he'd already decided for himself. We were standing at the gate to the grounds of Malvale. The house was some distance away, brooding at the top of its hill. From this vantage point, under the leaden sky, the great mansion was a dark shape, the silhouette of its towers jutting up from the walls. The details of the facade were invisible. Malvale was a hard mass of black, and I could understand the children's reaction, even as I regretted it. The grounds were rugged and broken, gnawed apart by the generations of mining. The industry that had burrowed into the stony hill was the foundation of the Strock family's wealth and power, though much of the machinery was quiet now. The seams were almost exhausted. We would not be drawing much more wealth out of the ground. We no longer needed to. With enough accumulation, wealth and all that flows from it is self-sustaining. "Ghosts do not exist," I told Xander and Katrin. "Do not offend the Emperor by believing in such nonsense." I spoke gently, but I needed them to know there were ideas no one should have. I patted Xander's shoulder and smiled at Katrin. "Anyway, you shouldn't be frightened of Malvale. You should be proud. This is our family's home. It is a great house. The greatest on Solus." "If it is our house, why don't we live there?" Katrin asked. She did not sound eager to do so, but at least it was curiosity rather than fear that prompted her question. "My uncle Lionel lives there now. It is his home because he is Lord Governor of Solus." Over time, the line between family estate and Governor's palace had blurred. Though Malvale was not officially the seat of government, it had become so in practice since the rise of the Strocks to prominence. As long as a Strock was governor, Malvale would be the governor's residence. Our line had had its share of travails, but there was still no sign that power might slip from our grasp, even in the present circumstances. "But you're governor," Katrin said. "Governor regent," I said. "Just for a little while, until Lionel is better." He had been ill for some time now. The precise nature of his affliction was unclear, and he had become a recluse, never leaving the house and rarely admitting visitors. He was an absent ruler, and I had been recalled from my Astra Militarum service as captain in the Solus Night March to act as governor until Lionel recovered, or a proper regency could be established. One that would naturally both ensure stability on Solus and see off any political challenges to Strock supremacy. This period lives, in my memory, as a golden time. I was home on Solus for most of a year, and had been given that rare opportunity for an officer, the chance to be a part of one's family, even if only for a short while. I had left to do my duty to the Imperium while Eliana was still expecting Xander. That I had been able to see Katrin through her first years had itself been an unusual dispensation, a privilege granted by my family's standing. I had not expected to return until, if I survived, late in my life, by which time both children would be complete strangers to me, assuming they were still on Solus at all, and not swept up in a subsequent Astra Militarum tithe themselves. So Lionel's affliction had become my blessing. That year was a glorious one. Its memory sustained me in the time that followed, whether I was facing the horrors of the battlefield or other, more personal griefs. But when I finally came back to Solus for good, it was this day that loomed over all the others, casting its shadow upon the entire year. Even before my return, it had begun to grow, metastasizing, becoming the dominant image of that year, hauling my thoughts back to it with an irresistible gravitational pull. I should have been recalling my games with the children in the grounds of the family's secondary residence near the centre of Valgast. I should have been picturing the two of them splashing in the fountains of the courtyard. I should have been thinking of Eliana and her smiles as she watched them. I should have been thinking of her hand in mine. Instead, I kept coming back to Katrin's fearful pronouncement and Xander's tears, and the moments that followed. "Will you ever be governing, Governor?" Katrin asked. I exchanged a glance with Eliana, and she pressed her lips tightly together, holding back a laugh. "That's hard to say," I answered. "It depends on whether Lionel has any children. An unlikely prospect at his age, but not impossible. If he does, then one of them will become governor, not me."
"Good,"
said Xander.
"Oh," I teased, "you don't think I'd make a good governor?"
Eliana had straightened up from hugging Katrin, but now our daughter pressed herself tightly against her mother's waist.
"We don't want to go in that house," she said.
"Please, Papa,"
Xander sobbed.
"No, Papa."
"We're not about to move there," Eliana said. She ruffled Katrin's hair and gave me a sign that it was time to go. "We can't even visit it, so stop your worrying." We started walking again. Xander quaking in my arms, Katrin clutching Eliana's hand and snuffling through her tears. We put the high wall of the grounds behind us as we headed back down the Mulvale Road, making our way through the industrial sector, back towards the residential quarters of Valgast. I looked over my shoulder to get one last glimpse of the house before a curve in the road took it out of sight. I had never feared Mulvale. It had always been a palace of dreams for me while I was growing up. It represented the highest summit a Strock could climb, the highest honour, and, as my understanding matured, the noblest duty. I did not think of it as haunted. When I look back at it, at that moment, I felt pity for Lionel, gratitude for my time as regent, and wistful longing to see again the halls that I had visited only once before. I had no dark thoughts. I felt no presentiment of menace. But when I turned back to my family, a wave of vertigo struck me. I stumbled, almost dropping Xander, as the ground turned treacherous beneath my feet. It seemed to be as thin as cobwebs, about to give way and throw us into a nightmare chasm. Xander was limp in my arms, his head a lolling dead weight, his neck broken. Eliana was dragging Katrin's corpse, heedless of the blood pouring from our daughter's open throat. I gasped, struggling to find the air to scream. I was drowning, falling, and suffocating all at once. And then the moment passed. The horror receded, evaporating from my memory. The road was solid, my children unharmed. I had had a brief, dizzy spell, that was all. My stride was sure, and within seconds, all that had happened was that I had looked forward too quickly and gone light-headed. For years, that was all I would recall. Even when the memory of Katrin and Xander's terror grew large, my terrible vision remained buried, hidden from my mind's eye. It did not resurface. Not until I returned to Solus. Not until I looked upon Mulvale once more. Chapter 1. Now. The antechamber to the Hall of Judgment on the battleship Eternal Fury was a semicircle, 54 paces across at its widest, I had counted. Against the fore wall, a single iron chair stood next to the heavy bronze doors that separated me from my judges. I had yet to sit in it. I could not keep still. I walked the periphery of the antechamber, finding no relief in movement, only the necessity to avoid the curse of stillness. To port and starboard were deck-to-ceiling windows, and from the port one I could see the charred lump of coal that had been the world of Clostrum. The world it had been my duty to save. Every time I passed before that view, I paused, wincing through fresh spasms of guilt. Averting my gaze was not within my power. The sight pulled me, hooks sunk into my soul. Again and again I stared at the dead world and then jerked away, my heart thumping hard, my gut dropping away, my left palm tingling with new sweat. There was no feeling in my right palm, nor anywhere else in my right arm or my right leg. Or more precisely, there was no natural feeling. They were my prosthetics, replacing the flesh and bone taken from me on Clostrum. I was not used to them yet. My pacing was more than restlessness. It was also my attempt to come to terms with the new realities of my body. The faint whirs of the servo motors were still an alien sound, a mechanic voice that I could not truly connect with myself. It was a whisper that followed me everywhere I went, its true source perpetually out of sight, though always near. The arm and the leg worked well, obeying the impulses sent by my brain. I did not consciously have to command their motions. At the same time, they were a strange land, a zone I did not recognize. They belonged to someone else, someone whose intentions perfectly reflected my own. I felt the phantom pains of my vanished limbs, and the aches corresponded to places on the prosthetics, yet did not come from them. I was a divided being, playing at unity. My soul was as split as my body. I was present in the moment and grappling with the agony of my shame. I was also distant, part of my mind retreating into a cocoon of numbness, observing my torment with a cold disinterest. I had been waiting in the antechamber for hours. When my eyes did not go to the ruin of Clostrum, they lingered on the relief sculpture of the bronze doors. On each was a massive figure, justice personified in heroic lines, arms crossed, jaw stern, gaze directed far above my head, as if seeing the arrival of judgment. There was no mercy to be had here, no concessions. I expected none. I desired none. I did not think I desired anything, not any longer. I awaited the call to pass through the doors with no impatience. I did not even feel the urge to get the process over with. There was only the shame, its spears battling with the protective shield of the numbness, the shield that held the memories of Clostrum at bay. I had to protect myself from them, or they would rip me apart. I would not be able to function at all. And if nothing else, I was determined to meet my fate with dignity. I owed that to my regiment and to my fallen troops. Steady, I whispered to myself as I approached the port window again. Steady. But the effort to avoid the memories backfired. Instead of blocking them, I summoned them. They stormed my defences. They came for me with pincers and claws that could shred a Lehman Russ like parchment. They came with bodies bloated with bioweapons. They came in a swarm that blotted out the sky and covered the land with an undulating carpet of horror. I saw the heroes of the night march, the soldiers who trusted me, who followed my commands without question, who looked to me for guidance and the path to victory. I saw the monsters turn them to blood and pulp. I saw the ocean of jaws devour my regiment. I was in the roof hatch of my command Chimera again. The giant horror rushed us. It towered over the vehicle, its body armoured with impregnable chitin, its huge arms ending in talons like serrated spears. It stabbed its talons through the flanks of the Chimera, lifted it from the ground and ripped it in two. It hurled the halves away. I went flying and landed 20 yards from the burning wreckage. I tried to stand. I tried to make my last stand, a worthy one. Before I could rise, the creatures were on me, marching over me, barely seeing me. One warrior form paused. Its talons pierced my shoulder and thigh. The agony was fresh again. The agony in the sound. The awful tearing of muscle and the cracking of bone. The agony in the smell. The mix of blood and the sharp burning stench of Xenos pheromones. The agony and the sudden absence. The parting of arm and leg from my body. And still other memories came. More fragmented, but just as terrible, maybe even worse. They were confused impressions of gunfire, light and darkness, screams and roars. They were my last impressions as I wavered in and out of consciousness, of the troopers who came to my aid and died saving their failed colonel. I hunched forward in the antechamber, clutching my false arm, my right leg feeling as if it were buckling, even though it could not. I gasped for air, and my nostrils were filled with the smell of Xenos and massacre. My eyes watered, my chest heaved. I growled, because if I didn't, I would scream. "Colonel, you may enter." The words jerked me from the memories. My eyes cleared. The bronze door had opened. Two men, one in the livery of the Imperial Navy, the other a surviving major of the Solus Night March, stood on either side of the doorway. I straightened up, cleared my throat, and gave the major a curt nod. His name was Hetzer. He had been among those who had saved me. He was one of the few who had survived doing so. I crossed the threshold into the Hall of Judgment. Four sculpted swords pointed to the centre of the vaulted ceiling, from which a great skull stared down. The room was circular, and I advanced down an aisle to its centre, to stand on a bronze aquila inlaid in the marble floor, directly beneath the gaze of the skull. A ring of thrones surrounded me. All were occupied. The majority of the authorities present were of the Astra Militarum, most notably General Perivan of the Solus Night March. There were a number of officers from the Imperial Navy as well, in deference to the fact that it was in their ship that this court was assembled. There were others too. There was Captain Numitor of the Ultramarines 8th Company. I had never seen him before, but I knew who he must be. We had all known that the Ultramarines were fighting on Clostrum, though they had not been present near the battle I had lost. This was the first time I had been in close proximity to one of the Adeptus Astartes. I was dwarfed by his colossal stature. I felt something even worse than shame to be in the presence of so noble a warrior. Sitting next to Perivan was a woman in solemn robes of black, laced with gold. She was very old. The heavy chain and pendant of the Adeptus Terror seemed to weigh her neck down, but her eyes were piercing. Perivan confirmed my surmise by introducing Numitor and presented the woman as Lady Arask. "The rest you know," he said. I did. I had the deepest respect for every officer in the room. It made my failure all the more painful to have it witnessed by them. "Colonel Mason Strock," said Perivan, "the Circular Judgment has been called to consider your actions in the battle for Clostrum. Do you understand your position in these proceedings?"
"I do, sir."
I stood straight. I stared at a point on the wall just above the General's head. "I understand that the work of the Circle is complete. Judgment has already been reached. I am here for it to be rendered, not to defend myself."
"Good,"
said Perivan. "Before we pronounce the verdict, this court would like to hear your evaluation of the event."
"Sir, I was charged with leading my regiment against the Tyranid invasion and protecting the civilian population of Hive Throndhelm. I failed in this task. My regiment was defeated, taking severe losses, and Throndhelm was overrun. So was all of Clostrum. In the wake of the Imperial defeat, Exterminatus was declared. I make no excuses for the part I played in losing a Forge world. Whatever the verdict of this court, I accept it with thanks and will do grateful penance."
Perivan toyed with the stylus in his hands.
"Colonel, though you've described the events accurately, your analysis is incorrect."
"Sir?" I asked, confused.
"You did not fail in your duty," said Numitor. "No success was possible, though none of us knew this at the outset of the battle."
"You slowed the Tyranids," Perivan said. "You bought enough time for a significant portion of the population of Hive Throndhelm to be evacuated off-world, along with a considerable amount of resources. Colonel, you are to be commended for your actions."
"Commended?" I repeated softly. The word tasted like sawdust.
"Though Clostrum was lost," said Numitor, "the larger Tyranid advance into this sector of the Imperium has been blunted, at least for now. You are part of a victory, Colonel, not a defeat."
The screams of devoured soldiers roiled in my memory, blotting out my sense of the chamber for a moment. If there was a triumph here, I could not find it.
"You fought hard," said Perivan. "You've done well, Colonel."
"Thank you, sir," I managed. His praise struck my soul like a curse.
"I look forward to serving with honour wherever the Night March is called to next."
It took a huge effort to utter those words. Sweat beaded on my forehead. Perivan exchanged a glance with Arask.
"No," said the noble who spoke for the Adeptus Terror.
"How much of the retreat do you remember?" Perivan asked before I could respond.
"Very little," I admitted. "I believe I was unconscious for most of it."
"Despite your wounds, you were not. You continued to issue commands throughout."
"Coherent ones?"
I turned to look at Hetzer. He looked uncomfortable.
"Speak freely, Major," said Perivan. "You will do no harm to your colonel. We already know the answer to his question. He does not, and he deserves the truth."
Hetzer cleared his throat.
"No," he told me. "Many of your orders could not be followed."
"Meaning you had the good judgment not to obey them," I said sadly.
"Was I delirious from blood loss?" I asked Perivan.
"The Medicaid officers have concluded that this was only partly the case. You were suffering from other forms of shock, Colonel." You have given what you could to the battlefield, Colonel Strock, Arask said. You have nothing left to give. What she said was true, and I knew it. Yet it felt like the most humiliating weakness to agree. Then she said, The Imperium still has need of your services. Hope flared. I was ready to agree to anything, as long as I could salvage even a thread of dignity. All I ask is to serve, I said. Tell us about your home world, Colonel, said Arask. I was puzzled, but did as she had asked. Solus is an agri-world, I said. Its seat of government is Valgast, which is also its largest city. Its exports to the Imperium are on the order of 12 billion tons a year. I trailed off, feeling foolish. I'm sorry, Lady Arask. I really don't understand what you want from me. You have told me what I wanted to hear. She glanced at the data slate in her hands. Colonel, would you be surprised to learn that exports from Solus have been gradually falling for some time? And that the current level is just under 10 billion tons a year? I would be, yes, though it has been many years since I've had news from Solus. Have there been droughts? Not of any unusual kind. The decline has been steady since the death of Lionel Strock. My uncle was incapable of governing for the latter part of his life. That was why the regency was established. Yes, and under your guidance the export levels were steady. In fact, they climbed. But not only is this no longer the case, evidence has also been uncovered of large quantities of Solus products entering black markets. I saw what Arask was implying. You believe the Governing Council has become corrupt? We do. Its members are engaged in war, profiteering on a large scale. Lionel Strock died over 30 years ago. Has the problem been festering that long? It has, but the Council has been careful. The decline of exports and rise of profiteering were very gradual, unnoticeable from year to year. The wheels of the administratum grind slowly. It is only recently that an audit of Solus's exports over the long term has been conducted. The corruption will be deeply rooted then. Indeed. Until now, your duty to the Imperium has been on the battlefield. But matters have changed. I am no longer useful in combat, I said. I managed to keep the bitterness from my voice. This is your new campaign, Colonel, said Perivan. We believe it is only a matter of time before the Council seeks to install a new Lord Governor, Arask went on. To date, it seems that the only barrier has been your hereditary claim. But that will not stop the Council indefinitely. You must return, Lord Governor Strock. Take up the title that is yours by right, and purge the Council of corruption. She paused. You must go home. She watched me, gauging the effect of her words. Home. I did not know if the word still had meaning. It had been so long. I was changed. Solus had changed too, in ways more profound and personal for me than the political situation. Home. I pushed the word as far from my consciousness as I could. That was not far enough. It would come back for me all too soon. I would have to try to be ready for it. I doubted I would be. Thank you, Lady Arask, I said. I mouthed the correct responses. They sounded flat to me, as if a servitor were speaking instead of me. I am grateful for this assignment. The word redemption rose in my thoughts. Redemption for what? For which sin? Or maybe this is punishment. Perhaps this court is sentencing you without realizing it. I will return honour to Solus. I'm sure you will, Lord Governor. That was twice she had used the title. She was emphasising my new role. I was no longer to think of myself as a colonel in the Astra Militarum. I was returning to the other tradition of my family. I was a noble, and the duties were of a very different nature. She was also reminding me of the authority she represented. General Perivan and the other officers might control what happened to me within the aegis of the Night March. It was not for them to declare me Lord Governor. Even my family claim on the governorship did not ultimately rely on any authority on Solus. No matter how strong my right may appear in the traditions of my home world, those traditions were subject to the decisions that could, at any time, emanate from the Adeptus Terror. Arask could make or unmake me with a word.
I saluted Perivan, then turned slowly, giving due acknowledgement to the full circle of my judges. They looked back at me impassively, expressions perfectly neutral. Hetzer and the Navy officer opened the doors of the chamber for me. "What are you thinking?" I wondered as I walked back down the aisle. I had been praised, not censured, but in every way that mattered, I was already no longer a colonel. "What do you see before you? Is that pity you are hiding? Is it gratitude that my fate is not yours? Is it contempt for my weakness?" I was glad not to know. I had self-loathing enough to keep me occupied. No matter what I'd been told, I despised the officer who had lost Hive Throndhelm. I hated the relief I felt in knowing that I would not be returning to combat. The echoes of screaming troops grew louder again. I managed to keep my breathing regular and my stride steady. I prayed to the Emperor for strength. I was terrified the memories would attack with all their monsters and shame me before I could leave the chamber. I made it out with my dignity intact. I allowed myself to take a long, shuddering breath when I heard the doors close behind me. I kept walking, my action mechanical, as if all my limbs were prosthetic, and as if movement alone would get me away from the waking nightmares. I stopped in front of the port window. The dead planet turned slowly beneath the ship. It was free of nightmares, free of hope. It was nothing now. I was almost envious. "I shall miss you, sir." I hadn't realized that Hetzer had followed me out. I did not jump. I took that as a small victory. "Thank you, Major." I turned my back on the sight of Klostrum. "Thank you for everything." His smile was crooked, skewed by the massive scar cutting across his face. He would bear the mark of saving his superior officer forever. "It was an honour to serve with you." "The honour was mine. I thank the Emperor that you will continue to lead. I imagine these are your last days as Major." He looked embarrassed. "So I've been told," he admitted. "I'm glad. Let me congratulate you and call you Colonel now before we part." We shook hands. "I hope your return to Solus goes well," Hetzer said. I made myself smile. I wasn't sure that it could. I was going home to mourning and to painful hope. I didn't know which was worse. That night, I dreamt about the day I showed Malvale to my children. My vision of their deaths rose from the grave of memories and roared. I woke with a gasp and with the shrieks of lost comrades in my ears. Chapter 2. The gate to Malvale was open when I arrived. I sat in the back of the car for a few moments after Belzec, my chauffeur, had pulled over. The grounds were waiting, after so long, for me to claim them as the new lord of the manor. The last time I'd seen Malvale, its site had been tainted by my children's tears, and the stain lingered. "Shall I drive in, Lord Governor?" Belzec asked. She was another veteran of the Night March, mustered out by extensive injuries. She'd been a sergeant, and her family was not wealthy, so her prosthetics gave her mobility, but not much more. The lower half of her body was a platform with motorized treads. Her mechanism slotted well into the vehicle, but outside the car she moved at a crawl. Her life was better than that of a servitor, but that was small reward for her service. "No, thank you," I said. "I'll walk the rest of the way." I wanted to feel the grounds as Malvale and I became properly acquainted for the first time. "Wait here. I'll need you to take me to the council hall afterwards." "Yes, Lord Governor." I got out of the car, shutting the door behind me with a hard clunk. The vehicle was an old one, as well maintained as it could be, though its engine grumbled loudly and the exhaust spewed blue smoke. It was a stolid thing, squat and heavy. It favoured strength over luxury, and I liked it. It sent the right signal about the kind of governor I intended to be. I walked up to the gate, dwarfed by the ancient walls surrounding the estate. It was 50 feet high, a massive rockcrete barrier stained black with time. It had not had to defend Malvale against an attack for as long as the Strocks had owned the land. But when Lionel had turned into a recluse, it had held off the curious, the concerned, and the scheming. The iron gate was just as high, each of its bars over a foot thick. I crossed the threshold into the land that was now mine and felt the strength of the wall at my back. Let the council do its worst. Its corruption, no matter how thorough, suddenly seemed a weak thing indeed compared to the power that resided on this hill.
A gatehouse crouched against the interior of the wall, its Gothic windows shadowed by its steeply gabled roof. It was the home of Wren Caroff, the major domo of Malvale. He'd offered to meet me at the gate, but I'd asked him to wait for me at the house itself. I needed the time alone to prepare myself. Things had changed since I had stood outside the gates with Eliana and the children. Hopes had died within its walls. This was not the return I had imagined for myself long ago. But hopes were not reality. It was reality that I must face. The route up the hill was barely a road. It twisted back and forth between the entrances to mines and quarries. The rockcrete had been broken up and rutted over the centuries by the passage of heavy machinery. The machines no longer travelled it. The mines were exhausted. Lionel had let the road fall further into disrepair, and nothing had been done to improve it since his death. I passed between gaping pits and dark tunnels burrowing into the bare stone of the hill. The mines were open graves. Here and there the bones of cranes and excavators marked the tombs. The day was chilly, and a north wind, soft but insistent and steady, blew through the iron skeletons with a rusting hollow whistle. As I drew closer to the top of the hill, I left the remains of the mining behind. There were trees here, and they were all dead, killed by the toxins that had permeated the ground in the wake of the excavations. The Strock estate had been the source of our power, but the price had been the ruin of the grounds. There was no beauty in this land. It was grey and hard, a pitted fossil. And though the trees were dead, they refused to fall. They surrounded Malvale with their petrified death, branches reaching out to the leaden sky, splayed, angled, clutching, pleading. The house had filled more and more of my vision during my ascent. Sometimes it disappeared behind a mound of ejecta, and then reappeared with greater force. The dead forest veiled it from view again, the tangle of branches and the crooked trunks concealing all but fragments of the house. Then I emerged from the trees, and it rose before me in its full power. I stopped, taking it in. "This is yours now. This belongs to you." I had trouble making myself believe that. The Strocks belong to Malvale. The thought was an odd one. I tried to dismiss it as unworthy fancy. It did not leave willingly because it was confident in its truth and it gnawed at my chest. I tried another tactic. "All right then, we belong to Malvale. It comes to the same. We are united in strength. Let me claim my birthright and use it to save Solus." Malvale had been standing long before the Strocks had made it their family seat. It had been built millennia ago, its birth lost in the fog of Solus's deeper history. Its walls were pitted and cracked, their edges worn by the slow claws of time. Malvale was there before us, and it would be there long after the Strocks were no more. This was not pessimism, this was a simple fact. Malvale did not hide its age. If anything, it looked even older than it was, as if it somehow predated Solus itself. And despite its age, or perhaps because of it, it did not seem frail. It was as solid as it was ancient. It was eternal. It would never fall. I could picture it, on the surface of post-exterminatus claustrum, defiant against all destruction, outliving worlds because it was an unalterable fact of the galaxy. It was a longhouse, the facade stretching far to my left and right. The tall, narrow, pointed windows were glowering eyes in its grim, impassive face. Two square towers guarded the main entrance, and narrower, conical towers rose over the battlements at regular intervals. To the west, at my left, the main body of the house adjoined the largest tower of them all. It was circular, massive, and much older even than the rest of the building. It was the remnant of an earlier structure, though it also looked as if it had given birth to the new house. The ferrocrete walls of Malvale were stained a dark grey, but the round tower was a deep black, as if it had turned into a knight of stone under the weight of Solus's history. Behind me, wind soughed through the dead trees, branches creaked like opening vault doors. Malvale was not a welcoming house. It never had been. That was not its purpose. I had, for much of my life, taken for granted that its purpose was to be the gravitation centre of the Strock family. But now, standing here, looking at its uncaring visage, trying to prepare myself for the morning that would return, hard, when I walked through its door, I knew that idea was a delusion. I had managed to hold on to it while I served in the Night March, far from the realities of Solus. I had held on to the lie because I had had to. It had given me comfort.
I could no longer believe in it now. I thought again of the day I'd brought Katrin and Xander to see Malvale. I remembered what Eliana had said that night, after we'd finally managed to get the children to settle down. We were preparing to go to bed, keeping half an ear open for the sound of sudden crying. "I suppose we'll be lucky if we make it to morning without being woken to deal with the nightmares," I sighed. "I did warn you," said Eliana. She folded back the covers and climbed into our bed. "What did you think was going to happen? That they would clamour to visit the magic castle?" "No, of course not. I thought for a moment, trying to remember why I had imagined the visit would have been a good idea. It's their heritage. It's part of who they are. It's important that they know that." "Agreed. When they're older." "I can see that now," I said sheepishly, getting in beside her. I put my arms around her and she nestled against my chest. "I just didn't think it would frighten them, that's all." "I love you, Mason, but how in the name of the Emperor could you not know they would be frightened by that house?" I could not remember what I had answered. I'd probably said something very weak and foolish, because there could not have been a good answer. "Didn't it scare you when you were little?" Eliana asked. "No." "Not even the first time?" "No, I mean..." I hesitated. "I don't think so. I can't remember the very first time I saw it." "Aha!" She had smiled, and I had really had no answer to that. I pictured that smile now. I wanted to tell her she was right. Not because she didn't know that she was right. I wanted her to know that I had learned. It was a pointless wish. All it did was make everything hurt a little more. So did standing here, waiting for nothing. "Get this done." I walked on, and the entrance loomed higher and higher above me. The massive oak doors opened as I approached, and Ren Karoff stepped out into the porch to greet me. "Welcome to Malvay, Lord Governor," he said, bowing low. "Thank you, Karoff. It's good to see you." I'd only ever met Lionel a couple of times. By contrast, I had come to know Karoff quite well during my time as Governor-Regent. He had been the only point of contact between Lionel and the outside world, a frustrating, thankless task he had undertaken with quiet, endlessly patient dignity. He had been old then, and he was ancient now. No one else had served the Strocks longer than he had. Seeing him made me feel, for the first time, that I had indeed returned home. He stood straight, despite his age. He was bald, his face deeply lined, but his cheekbones and chin still prominent. His brow was heavy, shadowing his eyes, lending him an air of perpetual deliberation. He moved with careful precision, slower now than when I had last seen him, but not frail. Karoff stood to one side and invited me in. "Work began as soon as we received word of your return," he began. "But there's still a lot to do," I finished. "There's no need to apologise. I could not have expected things to be otherwise. The house has been empty for a long time." "It has. It will be good to see it live again." The entrance hall took up the echoes of our voices, bouncing them off the marble floor and carrying them up the wide staircase that, ahead and to the left, rose to the landing. Doorways on both sides opened into cavernous halls. The one on the left held a dining table almost 20 feet long. Its dark surface gleamed, reflecting the candlelight from the great iron chandelier above. The sight of the dining hall held me for a moment. "When was that last used to entertain?" I asked Karoff. There was the slightest hesitation before he answered. "I believe your wife entertained guests here once," he said, and I managed not to wince. "Before that, I could not say. It has been a long time." I nodded. I did not say that things were about to change. I was not about to host gala receptions at Malvale. At the same time, the thought of eating alone in that space was too melancholy to contemplate. The dining room, and to the right of the entrance, the great hall had been thoroughly cleaned. Even so, an air of faded grandeur pervaded their space. The paintings on the walls had grown dark, their subjects difficult to make out. Webs of gossamer-thin cracks covered the walls. Malvale might stand forever. It would also decay forever. We were about to take the main staircase when I stopped, not sure what I'd heard. "Are there children here?" I asked. "No, my lord." "I thought I heard one laugh just now, didn't you?" "No,
My lord, he said again, there are no children in this house.
He was emphatic.
None of the serfs bring them here. This is no place for children.
Must have been mistaken, then.
A distorted echo of voices at work, I guessed. Shall I show you to your chamber?
Karoff asked.
I nodded, and we climbed the staircase. I took in the polish of the wood steps. There was no dust on the intricate ironwork of the balustrade. You have overseen impressive work already, I said. From elsewhere in the house, I could hear the confused, muffled din of the ongoing efforts to restore Mile Vale into a functioning residence.
We have focused on the areas that will be most visible or see the most use, Lord Governor, said Karoff. Much of the house is still in disrepair. There are many rooms that are nothing but storage of a kind.
In other words, filled with debris.
Yes, and furniture, collections of objects and much else. It'll be the work of years to set it right. And there are what appear to be family records, too, which we cannot touch.
I understand. Eliana wasn't here long enough to undo much of what happened under my uncle. I managed to refer to Eliana almost casually. I changed the focus of the conversation quickly. How bad did things get during Lionel's decline? I had some idea from my dealings with Karoff during my regency. I guess the full picture was worse than I'd known then, and had become much worse afterwards.
They were as bad as could be, Lord Governor. I did not even know the full extent until after your uncle's death. In his final years, he rarely left his bedchamber. There were many days when he barred the house to all, including the staff.
To you as well?
Yes. When he died, it was many days before we found him.
That was a lonely thought.
None of the serfs who worked at Mile Vale lived within its walls. Karoff, in the gatehouse, was the one closest to the hall. All the others had quarters in Valgast. They arrived at the gates with dawn, and the last of them would leave each night after I retired. This had been the way of things for generations. I doubted if anyone knew if this tradition had developed to respect the privacy of the Strocks or for some other reason. Given the frequently troubled history of my family, I could well imagine that even when, as with Lionel, serfs were forbidden to live in the house, they likely would have chosen not to anyway, preserving a necessary sanity-maintaining distance between themselves and their unstable master. I pictured Lionel alone in his colossal house, floating through the corridors like a phantom, finally dying with no one around, no one to know, no one to grieve. And then, unwillingly, I saw Eliana too, also alone, swallowed by all this immensity, another phantom lost to the night spaces of Mile Vale. She had moved into Mile Vale after Lionel's death. I was Lionel's closest living descendant, and the house had come to us. I could not return to take up the governorship, and Senior Councillor Veth Montfort had succeeded in blocking any attempt to have Eliana declared acting governor in my absence. I had been too successful in making the regency stable. With hindsight, I realised that I should have been more suspicious of the council's cooperation than I had been. Still, Eliana's residence in Mile Vale had been intended to remind the council that the Strock still ruled Solus. Katrin and Xander did not accompany her. They were away in boarding scholar, in the early phases of education that would take them across Solus and train them in their responsibilities as nobles. They did not return to Valgast until well after her death. That was a small mercy. At least it was one. We reached the first floor, where a long gallery led to the private chambers. The wall was lined with portraits of my ancestors, half concealed by gloom and the waxy reflections of candle flame. The windows at the far end of the gallery barely admitted enough light from the dull day to see by. Karoff led me to a door at the eastern end of the gallery, which opened to another flight of stairs. We were in one of the corner towers now, and my bedchamber was at the top, with an iron ladder outside the door leading to a trapdoor in the roof. It took up the entire width of the tower. Windows looked out on all four sides. There was more natural light here than in what I'd seen of the rest of the house so far, though the glass was thick, old and stained. My view of the grounds was bleary. The landscape looked swathed in fog. The furnishings were old too, though in good repair. A four-poster bed dominated the centre of the chamber, and there was room enough for a desk in the northeast corner and a pair of deep armchairs next to a fireplace in the western wall. A spiral tapestry carpet covered the floor. It was from Donham,
in the southern hemisphere of Solus. It depicted the ascendance of the world over its history into the light of the Emperor, which radiated from the centre. The carpet was worth more than the entire apartment my family and I had lived in during my regency. I looked at the bed. After decades of cots, it seemed grotesquely huge and empty. "Was this room my wife's?" I asked.
"Yes," said Karoff. "It is the master bedchamber," he explained. "Do you wish to move?"
"No, I wanted to know, that's all."
"It was not here that..."
he began. "I know, I know. Thank you, Karoff. That will be all for now." Karoff withdrew, leaving me alone in the room that I should have shared with Eliana. Instead, we would both sleep here, decades apart. I felt physically close to her as I stood there. At the same time, her absence was a sudden blade in my chest. "I'm sorry," I said aloud. My words sounded muffled, falling dead in the still air of the chamber. "I miss you." The silence felt like an accusation. Guilt following me like a shadow, I went to the south window and looked down onto the hard ground below. Chapter 3. I was composed again as Belzec drove me through Valgast towards the council hall. I'd passed through the first trial of my return. Another lay ahead. I did not expect my first encounter with the ruling council to go smoothly. That was not the trial, though. I welcomed the coming struggle. It was a battlefield I was determined to conquer. I was hoping for a campaign that would silence the clamour of the dead of Clostrum. The trial was going to be Xander. He would be there. I was going to see my son for the first time in over 30 years.
"Do you find Valgast much changed, Lord Governor?"
Belzec asked.
"Somewhat. Not as much as I might have expected.
Change for the worse, though, I expect, if I may speak freely."
"I thank you for doing so. And yes, things look worse." Though Valgast was the largest population centre on Solus, it was not a big city by Imperial standards. The people of this world were spread across the globe, the vast majority working its great farms. The population levels were not permitted to rise past a point that would see settlements impinge upon precious fertile land. The ties to the Night March held Solus's numbers at a stable level. Valgast itself was home to a few 100,000 souls. It was the more important off-world transportation hub on the planet, and it was where the administration of exports and tithe quotas was overseen. The city was home to the upper echelons of the farming authorities as well. Disputes between the huge collectives were settled here, and productivity targets were set based on regional conditions. This was where the wealth of the world was concentrated, and it seemed that in the years since my departure, that wealth had grown more concentrated. Public works were being neglected. Too many of the roads on which we travelled were not being properly maintained. The buildings were dingier, shabbier.
"From what I see," I said, "the council should be doing more, wouldn't you say?"
Belzec snorted. "And please," I added, "continue to speak freely."
"A great many might say that the council is doing quite enough, thank you very much."
"Quite enough for themselves, you mean?"
"Aye, Lord Governor, and quite enough squeezing of riches from everyone else to them. But when something needs repairing, there's always a good reason why it can't be done. The treasury is strained. There are other demands. We must all do what we can since the Imperium is at war."
"As I'm sure you all do," I said, "except perhaps the councillors."
"They don't appear to be tightening their belts, Lord Governor."
"No, they do not, nor their friends."
"The big landowners."
"Yes, my lord."
"And somehow, Solus's exports have still been dropping."
"It is a mystery," said Belzec wryly. "Truly, it is."
The industrial sector that had grown up at the base of Malvais Hill had turned into a ghost town since the mines had shut down. The first part of the decay that I'd witnessed was, in fairness, something beyond the council's control. We bumped down pitted streets between the empty shells of Manufactoria. Some complexes were still active, chimneys belching black and brown smoke into the sky, but the activity of the zone had easily been cut in half. Further in were the residential sectors. The ones nearest the Manufactoria were dark, crowded slums. The further we left the Manufactoria behind, the wealthier the districts became.
The facades of the hab blocks showed ornamentation instead of filth, and the citizens were visibly more prosperous. But here, too, the streets were narrow, barely wide enough for a single lane of traffic, the buildings close together as if huddling against the coming winter. Valgast was far north of Solus's equator. The moist climate that made the land fertile turned the city clammy, shivering in the months after the harvest. We crossed a bridge over the sluggish waters of the Oblivious River and entered the administrative sector of the city. At its centre, the Cathedral of Faith Unmerciful faced the council hall across the wide square of the Emperor's Bounty. Belzec dropped me off in front of the ornate facade of the hall. Above the main entrance was a winged representation of War's Harvest. It had sheaves of wheat at its feet. In one hand it held a sickle, and in the other, a sword. Above War's Harvest, stretching across half the facade, was a golden aquila. I looked up at the double-headed eagle as I mounted the stairs to the doors. Its majesty and size gave me purpose. The gold made me think of what I'd come to fight. The aquila predated the regency, but it seemed now a symbol of the councillors' ostentation and hypocrisy. They had sworn to serve the emperor. They served the gold instead. A militia guardsman saluted and pulled the brass doors open for me. The first drops of rain began to fall, thick drops splattering against the paving stones of the square, and I stepped inside. The entrance hall was an echoing stone space, its vaulted ceiling overlooking 10 floors of arched galleries. Ahead of me was a great marble staircase, flanked by 2 huge winged skulls in bronze. Waiting for me at the foot of the stairs was Veth Montfort. "Thank you for meeting me, Senior Councillor," I said. She gave me a polite, cold smile. "I feel this greeting is inadequate. For Solus to once again have a governor after so long is, one should think, an event that should be properly marked." "I think it is being properly marked," I said. "I'm here to get things done, not to indulge in ceremony. It would be wrong to begin in a way that was not in keeping with that goal, wouldn't you say?" She bowed slightly in acquiescence. "As you wish. Shall we?" We climbed the stairs together, 2 enemies taking the measure of each other. Montfort was maybe 10 years older than I was. She wore her long grey hair pulled back with severity. Her face was lined with experience, and it was the experience of the great river of corruption that was so deep an inheritance of her family that it seemed a point of pride. Her nose had rotted away, and a long tubal prosthetic coiled from her nasal cavity around the back of her head, then plunged through her throat, linking to her bionic larynx. Her voice was patrician, yet flat, and buzzed around the edges. She wielded her monotone like a rapier. She walked with a diamond-headed cane, wrapping its tip on the marble with a proprietary firmness. I had dealt with her as little as possible during my regency. Our families had a long history of enmity. The Montforts had been the most powerful house on Solus, until the mineral wealth of Malvale's Hill had pushed the Strox into ascendance. The Montforts had never forgiven us for taking away the rulership of Solus, which they felt was rightfully theirs. While Lionel was still alive, I did not have the full authority of the governorship. Direct confrontations with Veth Montfort would have been counterproductive, and the bad blood between us would have made our conflicts look like a personal feud. Perhaps they would have been. She was not as powerful then as she was now, so I'd been able to work around her. I did not delude myself into thinking I could do the same thing again.
"I suppose," Montfort said, "that it would be too much hope that we could work together rather than against each other."
The corner of her mouth curled in mockery. "I don't see why we can't," I said, fencing. "Do we not both serve the Emperor? Do we not both have the welfare of Solus at heart?"
"Oh, we do," she said. "At least, I think we do. Of course, some of my fellow councillors might understandably wonder whether the intentions of an outsider are entirely trustworthy."
"You amuse me, Senior Councillor."
"I'm glad to hear it."
Montfort took me to the uppermost floor, and the chamber of the Inner Council. The full body of the council had representatives from every region of Solus. Its sessions were more in the order of an airing of grievances than anything else. The actual governance of the planet was in the hands of a small number of Solus's most powerful families. The banners of the agri sectors of Solus hung over the assembly. The coats of arms of the great houses were mounted on the walls, resplendent in images of harvest and blade. The conjunction of the banners and shields implied an inherent connection between the families and the agri-sectors. This was very close to the truth. The nobility had its roots sunk deeply into the soil of the world. Power did not change hands easily on Solus. The rise of the Strox had acquired an almost mythical status because it was the first and only major shift in a family's fortunes and the power it wielded in many centuries. The council thrones were arranged in a horseshoe shape, at the top of which was the Lord Governor's seat, so long empty. On its right was the throne of the senior councillor. And so a Strox comes once again to unseat a Montfort from power. I was careful to keep my thoughts from showing on my face. The doors through which we entered were on the opposite side of the chamber from the governor's throne. The other seats were filled, and the 8 nobles rose to greet us, watching us carefully. I looked steadily back, gauging the forces before me. Some I knew from long ago. The others I had researched carefully during my voyage back to Solus. Montfort paused with me just inside.
"Councillors," she pronounced, "this is a day of rejoicing. The need for the regency has at last come to an end. Once more, Solus has a Lord Governor. I present to you Lord Governor Mason Strock. Long may he serve the Emperor."
"Long may he serve the Emperor," the council echoed. I made my way to the throne, then turned, still standing, and nodded. "I thank you," I said, "for this warm welcome." We were all lying to each other. Maintaining the fiction of civility to start with was necessary. I needed to get my footing before I could learn what action I had to take, against whom and when. "I thank you as well for your long and patient service to Solus." It was hard to keep anger out of my voice. "I come to this position in gratitude and with determination. I have been sent to oversee specific tasks that the Imperium expects on Solus. I am going to rip your corrupt carcasses from the hills of your spoils. I know that with your help, I will see these tasks through to fruition. I don't expect you to repent, but if you decide you fear me more than Vethmont IV, I might allow you to survive." There was polite applause, and we sat. I looked at 2 councillors in particular to see how they were reacting to my speech. One was Adriana Weiss. She was grinning at me. Of everyone here, she was the only one who seemed genuinely pleased to see me. She looked as if she'd understood every nuance that lurked behind my words. And then there was Xander. My son had been small enough to carry when I last saw him. I barely recognised the man who managed to sit indolently in the iron-backed chair. He was watching me with idle curiosity. He did not seem hostile. He did seem disinterested. His clothes, exquisitely tailored, gave the impression of having been chosen with such care that their wearer had little energy left for any other endeavour. His hair and beard were trimmed to fussy perfection. He looked like a man who was actively looking forward to being somewhere that he considered much more entertaining than his current surroundings. I called the council to order and made a formal show of deferring to Montfort. "I'll thank the senior councillor to guide us through the agenda for the day. I will rely on all of your expertise to show me what I need to know. I have no doubt you will." This was my reconnaissance. I would learn about this battlefield before I stormed it. The matters before us turned out to be very mundane. There were the likes of some minor jurisdictional disputes,